Welcome to Sidactic Residency Edition. I am Dr. O'Leary, a third-year psychiatry resident in the National Capital Region. This podcast is a collection of my thoughts, some of which might even be insightful. But please, make no mistake, these thoughts should not be confused with the opinions of the federal government, the Department of Defense, the Defense Health Agency, or the Cobblers Guild. The intended audience is psychiatry residents, but all are welcome. This episode is the second in an intermittent series I'm calling In a Word. Psychiatry is full of terms that are either poorly defined or used in such broad ways that they're not really all that helpful by themselves. The last word I wrestled with was perseveration. Trying to come to terms with the terms we throw around can help us to understand the conditions that we treat better, and hopefully will help us to communicate more precisely and effectively in the future. Dissociation is a word that has frustrated me. I've heard it used to describe everything from daydreaming to a feeling of complete detachment from someone's own body, or to describe people who have lost their sense of identity and have started to act as if they have a completely different identity. These are obviously very different things. The term is used to describe various aspects of many psychiatric disorders. It's prominently featured in disorders like borderline personality disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, there's even a controversial diagnosis called dissociative identity disorder. And when rampaging around the internet and in journals, I found a definition from Psychiatric Times of dissociation that I felt might capture what most of us want to mean when we say a patient is experiencing dissociation. I quote, "Dissociation involves disruptions in the usually integrated functions of consciousness, memory, identity, and perception of the self and the environment," unquote. That is a simple and somewhat elegant definition. But without being able to think of specific examples or particular patients, it's a bit hollow. We could do an entire episode on what it means to be conscious, or to have an identity, or to perceive one's self, or to have memory, but I'm not sure doing that would be helpful right now. According to this definition, dissociation messes with those things, in a way in which there's some sort of disintegration of information within our conscious or remembered experiences. Another similar definition I encountered was credited to a paper by Spiegel et al. In 2011. Please find my references at the end of the show transcript at sidactic.buzzsprout.com. In this paper, dissociation is, quote, "disruption of and or discontinuity in the normal subjective integration of one or more aspects of psychological functioning, including, but not limited to, memory, identity, consciousness, perception, and motor control." This definition is a bit more broad and describes a variable set of potentially unrelated phenomena.
Phenomena.
Related to the term dissociation are terms such as depersonalization and derealization, when patients have the transient feeling that they're somehow a passive observer of either their own body, their own self, or some kind of ghost that's observing the world around them without really being a part of it. It's helpful to be very specific about what we're talking about, because the term dissociation used out of a defined context resembles useless technobabble or deep-sounding gibberish. I hope that after this episode, the listener will understand that what is going on inside the brain of someone who has, for example, lost their sense of reality, may be entirely different from someone who has a transient loss of identity, or who is experiencing a flashback, or who is emotionally disconnected, or who cannot move their body despite having a completely intact nervous system. I also would encourage the listener to avoid using the term dissociation when something more specific will work, such as the patient was experiencing an episode of depersonalization versus, well, they were dissociated. As a metaphor, think of how useful it would be if I told you that I store my milk in the appliance. I'm sure that you would imagine that I mean the refrigerator, but I just might prefer to stick it in the dishwasher or the oven or the dryer. Dissociation is a broad categorical term that needs a lot of context. Now that I'm done complaining about that, I want to move on to complaining about something else I stumbled across while trying to understand what people meant when they used the term dissociation. There were many attempts to fit dissociative phenomenon into other kinds of, let's call them explanatory heuristics. For example, because some people who experience trauma or a threat become disconnected from, or at least do not remember, experiencing certain things like pain or fear or other emotions, or their sense of time is altered, or they describe a sense of being outside of their body as a dispassionate observer, that these experiences have somehow evolved as adaptive or protective mechanisms. PTSD is defined by traumatic experience, and traumatic experiences that occur during development, while not like defining borderline personality, are highly associated with borderline personality disorder. But just because certain reactions or behaviors exist in a subset of a population doesn't mean that they were at some point directly selected for or must confer an advantage in some situations. They may just be malfunctions that occur occasionally because of how difficult it is for our brain to keep itself running smoothly. It might be part of the cost we pay for complex brains. But whether dissociative phenomenon are a bug or a feature is not known. And while it can be fun to, you know, or it can be satisfying to speculate that various kinds of dissociation are adaptive responses, I don't think that they should be sold that way, because honestly, we just don't have good evidence for that. In fact, many kinds of dissociation are debilitating or leave sufferers in highly vulnerable states. To get more specific, I have time today to describe only one kind of dissociative phenomenon, depersonalization, which is commonly described in particular psychiatric disorders such as depersonalization, derealization disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and borderline personality disorder. It is also described as a transient feature within the population at large and during certain substance use experiences. Older hypotheses of depersonalization focused on things that could be measured more readily, such as signaling molecules within the hypothalamic pituitary axis, like cortisol. Depersonalization, derealization disorder patients were characterized by having low basal cortisol levels and significant hyposuppression of the hypothalamic pituitary axis to low-dose dexamethasone administration. There were also hypothesized associations with the anterior cingulate gyrus, the medial prefrontal cortex, and the amygdala, because we know these regions have certain functions that appeared to be affected. Later researchers hypothesized dysfunctions of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex and the anterior insula. It was proposed that the prefrontal cortex may suppress activity in limbic and salience regions, resulting in a feeling of numbness or detachment. Others have proposed that reduced activity in the anterior cingulate and the anterior insular cortex results in patients lacking awareness of interoceptive signals, those signals that come from inside your body, such as hunger and autonomic arousal, which makes them feel disconnected from themselves. You might remember some of the regions that I've just talked about, because I've mentioned them before in different episodes. The dorsolateral prefrontal cortex is a hub of the central executive network. The medial prefrontal cortex is part of the default mode network. The amygdala helps a lot in the salience network. And these are all part of what some people call a triple network model. So it's obviously hard to just plop someone down in an fMRI or a PET scan during these episodes of depersonalization. So our measurements are limited not only by the inherent precision of the tools themselves, but by the patient's experiential state. Typically, patients who have certain disorders such as depersonalization and derealization disorder, borderline personality disorder, or post-traumatic stress disorder are asked to rate the frequency and severity of their depersonalization and are then challenged with certain kinds of images or scenarios that researchers hope will either induce a state of depersonalization or at least put the brain in something approaching that state. Otherwise, they're just trying to look for like baseline differences in functional connectivity or activity in particular brain regions in affected individuals versus control population that might make them more susceptible to becoming depersonalized. A 2017 review titled Dissociation and Alterations in Brain Function and Structure, Implications for Borderline Personality Disorder, reported on results of various studies, including patients reporting depersonalization. They reported on a 2001 study that used fMRI among patients with chronic depersonalization. They reported, quote, "In response to adverse images, depersonalization disorder patients reported less arousal and showed diminished activity in the occipitotemporal cortex, the anterior cingulate cortex, and the insula, compared to OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and healthy controls." Unquote. They hypothesized that these results might mean these patients have impaired interoceptive and emotional awareness. They also reported a study of similar patients that showed, quote, "a stronger coupling of the dorsomedial prefrontal cortex, Brodmann area 9, and posterior cingulate cortex." This indicates that the default mode network may be acting out of bounds of its normal correlation with other networks. The posterior cingulate cortex is one of the hubs of the default mode network. It would be overwhelming to report all of the results here of the different papers that they talked about, but I do want to point out that many of them identified the anterior cingulate cortex as either functioning abnormally or not connected in a normal way to other brain regions in various studies. But there's a lot of variability in these studies, so we can't say that even depersonalization, one type of dissociation, is obviously caused by a single kind of brain dysfunction. I want to read to you part of a paper in Frontiers of Human Neuroscience from March 2022 titled Past and Future Explanations for Depersonalization and Derealization Disorder, A Role for Predictive Coding. But before I do that, I will try to summarize what they're talking about here. And before I do that, I want to warn you that I may not actually have understood their paper very well at all, because my primary state of mind when reading this paper was one of confusion. But here is my attempt, anyway. Our brains are predictive machines. We can live in the world because we can predict the future. We make predictions like, this ball is coming at my face, I need to stop it. By the time that ball reaches our face, we haven't even perceived that it's there yet because there's a delay. So we have to be able to perceive that it's going in a direction, and then that direction has to be extrapolated and turned into something that would help us to react to it and stop it from hitting our face. So we have to predict things. We also have to predict things like doing this will help me, or doing this will hurt me, or this action will result in some kind of outcome, whether, you know, neutral, it doesn't have to hurt or help us. Or things like nausea means I ate something bad and need to puke it up. etc. Bad predictive functioning may underlie disorders such as depersonalization and derealization disorder. When certain brain regions that normally would be functioning well together to give us a sense of self and existence in the world are malfunctioning or not communicating well with other areas, our brains still try to make sense of this. The brain can tell something is wrong. It can recognize prediction errors, such as this sensory input is normally associated with a response from another part of my brain, but that response was not what I expected. But the brain doesn't necessarily know what to do about the error. Drugs like THC and cannabis, LSD and psilocybin can induce states like this, especially the first few times they're tried, as the brain tries to make sense of malfunctioning networks and a flood of prediction errors that it generates. Andrew Gaddis, or Gaddis, not sure how to pronounce these names, so please forgive me, Graham Jamieson, and Bruce Stevenson, in that paper I mentioned before, explain a hypothesis that the brain can deal with prediction errors in certain ways. It can, one, suppress or ignore the error, two, use the erroneous prediction that it is generating to basically rewrite how it will interpret the same information in the future, i.e. change its own mind about what that information means. Or three, it can change aspects of one's own internal state or external environment so that the input from the environment matches better with what the brain expects. They call this active changing of the internal or external environment active inference. Now I will let them speak for themselves. I quote, "If prediction error can be managed through suppression, ignoring of errors, plus revision of predictions as previously discussed, active inference allows for an additional means of managing such errors, which can be achieved through changing the sampling of the sensory environment to better match predictions, such as may occur when physiological arousal is increased in response to a prediction of imminent threat. This process is believed to operate hierarchically with different bodily mechanisms responsible for altering sampled sensory data through action, dependent on the modality of the descending higher-level prediction. For instance, descending interoceptive predictions from higher hierarchical predictions may enslave lower-level autonomic reflex arcs. For proprioceptive predictions, higher-level descending predictions may drive the activation of motor reflex arcs. In this way, perception and action become intrinsically linked in exteroceptive, proprioceptive, and interoceptive domains." Unquote. The more that I read that, the less I think I actually understand it, and it is humbling. I'm glad that there are neuroscientists who are able to propose models of brain function like this and think of ways to test them. This is the only way psychiatry can really make large advances in the future. At least, I'm convinced of that. We've appeared to have reached an asymptote with regards to discovery of new drugs or creating completely new psychological models of brain function. And while exploring the mechanism of action of the treatments that we have discovered so far can help us advance neuroscience, I strongly believe that only neuroscience doing experiments outside of this realm is going to be able to make meaningful breakthroughs in the future that will inform new or novel treatments. I want to end by giving you responses that I received from ChatGPT regarding dissociation and depersonalization. I had this episode almost complete when I queried it, because I wanted to see how its responses compared with my own research, and I didn't want it to influence my own analysis. So I'll start with the first question. ChatGPT, define and describe dissociation as it relates to psychiatric disorders.
Dissociation refers to a disruption or detachment of one's thoughts, memories, feelings, identity, or sense of reality. Dissociation can occur as a defense mechanism against overwhelming stress, trauma, or anxiety, and can result in temporary or prolonged experiences of feeling disconnected from oneself, one's surroundings, or reality. In psychiatric disorders, dissociation is commonly associated with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, dissociative disorders, borderline personality disorder, and other conditions. For example, individuals with PTSD may experience flashbacks or dissociative episodes that involve reliving traumatic events or feeling detached from the present moment. Dissociative disorders are a group of conditions that involve persistent or recurring episodes of dissociation, which can range from mild to severe. These disorders include dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple personality disorder, dissociative amnesia, and depersonalization/derealization disorder. Dissociative identity disorder is a rare and complex condition in which an individual experiences two or more distinct and separate identities or personalities, each with their own patterns of behavior, memories, and thoughts. These identities take control of the individual's behavior or perception, leading to gaps in memory or changes in behavior that may be confusing or distressing. Dissociative amnesia is a condition in which an individual experiences gaps or complete loss of memory for significant periods of time, often related to traumatic or stressful events. Depersonalization/derealization disorder involves persistent or recurrent experiences of feeling detached or disconnected from oneself or the external world, leading to a sense of unreality or confusion. Overall, dissociation is a complex and multifaceted phenomenon that can manifest in various ways across different psychiatric disorders, and treatment typically involves addressing underlying trauma or stress, as well as developing coping strategies to manage dissociative experiences.
Now I'll move on to the next question. ChatGPT. What type of brain activity causes depersonalization?
Depersonalization is a dissociative symptom that is characterized by a sense of detachment or estrangement from one's own thoughts, feelings, or body. The exact neural mechanism underlying depersonalization are not fully understood, but there is evidence to suggest that it may be related to altered activity in several brain regions, including prefrontal cortex. There is evidence to suggest that depersonalization may be related to reduced activity in the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in self-awareness, decision-making, and emotional regulation. Temporoparietal junction. The temporoparietal junction is involved in the integration of sensory information and in the perception of one's body in space. Altered activity in the temporoparietal junction has been observed in individuals with depersonalization. Anterior cingulate cortex. The anterior cingulate cortex is involved in emotion regulation, attention control, and conflict monitoring. There is evidence to suggest that activity in the anterior cingulate cortex may be reduced in individuals with depersonalization. Insula. The insula is involved in interoception, the ability to sense the internal states of the body, and emotion processing. Alterations in insula activity have been observed in individuals with depersonalization. It is important to note that depersonalization can have many different causes, and the exact neural mechanisms underlying the symptom may vary depending on the individual and the underlying condition.
I think these are fair responses. It is important for me to state here that I do not endorse using ChatGPT for any professional activities yet, especially in medicine. It is in its infancy, and while it can be a good tool for some purposes, its behavior is still unpredictable, and its results are often erroneous. But the same can be said of people. I also thought of one question that I want to leave you with about the use of ChatGPT that I have not yet seen really addressed in articles that I've read about it. If an AI such as ChatGPT is going to start producing much of the content that we're going to be using on the internet, and then it is subsequently going to be training itself on content on the internet, then at some point, won't it just be using its own output to train itself? I'll leave you with that, and thank you for listening. I am Dr. O'Leary, and this has been an episode of Sidactic Residency Edition.